Okay.
Good evening, everyone. Tonight is November 14th, 2017. It's the second session of our I Engage Israel Milestones of Jewish History class. And I want to begin with a few announcements. First of all, our registrar, are you acting as registrar, Carol? Is there and is very happy to collect checks in any amounts that we wish to provide. And I want you to know the money she is collecting is not, it's going through Temple Aliyah, but it is actually not coming to us. And the reason is that, as I mentioned in the introduction to the course, in the materials that introduced the course, as a benefit of taking this class, you get a course packet, a hard copy course packet. And some of these have arrived. And so we're going to distribute these. And from this moment on, you will not need to make photocopies of any of the texts. Everything you need is in here. It's also available online. Has everyone been able to find the site online and make access, get access? Okay. Now, we have 18 of these have arrived. I don't know how many people are here tonight. Can somebody count? Is it more than 18?
Yes.
Okay, if it's more than 18, then we need some kind of a system for distributing them to the people who are here. We could, could do a, I don't know, Russian roulette or something, but that's probably not appropriate. But maybe if you could share, so then maybe that would be great. Maybe you could share, and therefore maybe we can ultimately just about get around to all of them. Does that make sense? Could you share? And only for 1 week, because the other one should be in by next week. Okay. Are you
registered
for this class?
Yep.
Okay. Here we go. And well, sure, if you don't mind, it would be great. Thank you so much, Marla. Okay. I think there are 18. And we can Okay, well, we're running. I don't know. For some reason, it seems like the numbers got. This is it. So I don't know how that happened, but do we have enough here?
No.
Okay, and I don't need one. I look, we all have access to materials online, but it is nice sometimes to have the hard copies. Okay, so that's number one. Number two. I want to remind you what we did last time, first structurally and then in terms of content, and suggest what we're going to do tonight. And that will give you, a nice preview of the rest of the course. Last time, what we did was I gave a brief introduction to the class as a whole, and then I took a look at those texts that are in the packet that you all had hard copies of last time, that sort of, are establishing, they are the basis for certain points made in Daniel Hartman's lecture on the first subject, on the first topic, which was the 1917 Balfour Declaration. Then we listened to that lecture. It was longer than most lectures will be because it included a 10-minute introduction to the course as a whole. And that pretty much brought us to the end of our time together. We just had a few quick questions, and then we concluded. And as I mentioned, every unit has a lecture of that kind, and it has a roundtable discussion. And I had originally intended to come here with you this evening and to just go right to the roundtable discussion and then to discuss it. But I watched the roundtable discussion again, and it seemed to me that what we could try to do is to review the material from last time and then begin with some of those questions that I asked you that we'd be talking about today and seeing whether that fleshes out the material well enough so that we could perhaps leave it to you, if you'd like, to watch that roundtable discussion on your own. And one advantage of that is that I don't think we need the roundtable discussion to come to the insights that that I'm looking for us to discuss tonight. And in a sense, watching it delays us a little bit. And when you turn down the lights and you turn on the screen, it's hard to stay awake at night for too long. So that's my judgment for this one. And I'd like you, though, already to anticipate that, to mention that you should watch the roundtable sometime during the week and let me know what you think. And then we'll move on to the next unit next time. And then you'll give me some feedback about whether you like doing it this way or like doing it that way. Got it? Okay. So let's first review. This should take very little time because I remember you were all here last time. You remember what we talked about. In ancient times, when the Jews first became a people, I'm just giving you an answer here. We Jews understood that we were members of a people. The notion of Jewish peoplehood is very ancient, and we see it in the Bible and beyond. We therefore shared what Daniel Hartman comes to call the Judaism of belonging. The idea that we're not just individual people in the world. We're not just individual people who happen to be called Jews in the world. We are part of a people. And being part of a people is something that you inherit. You don't have to do anything to be a part of a people. You're just a member of a people, and that's it. It's a state of being. But in addition, and you get this explicitly from that text in Exodus, we have understood that we have duties, that we have responsibilities, and that we are all in, as Daniel Hartman calls it somewhat, a little bit confusedly to me, in a state of becoming. So he calls it the Judaism of becoming. You could call it the Judaism of belief and practice and of mitzvot. You get the difference. Yeah. And you could understand that even throughout the, 1900 years in which Jews were wandering around the world, on the one hand, Jews had a sense that we're part of a people, and on the other hand, that they also have additional responsibilities that are incumbent upon them. Hence, you have this notion of Judaism of belonging and Judaism of becoming. Okay. That twin conception, which I guess Daniel Hartman would probably say were in a nice balance with one another, survived until the early part of the 19th century. Actually, I guess it's the end of the 18th century, the beginning of the 19th century. Two simultaneous cataclysmic social developments occurred in Europe at the time. Those are, anybody want to take a guess at what the two of them are?
The Enlightenment.
And that has to do with rationalism and thinking and beginning to think about as human beings, as individuals. Admittedly, the focus was on men, but we'll leave, and white men at that, but we'll leave that distinction out of it. And the other piece of it, the consequence of rationalism, was a perception that it just was unseemly that there were citizens and non-citizens, that there were full-fledged human beings and, you might say, subhuman human beings. And so therefore, together with the Enlightenment came what's called emancipation. Now, we tend to think of, when I remember when I was growing up, I'm just going to write these terms up here. Enlightenment and emancipation. I remember when I first learned the word emancipation, my association was with slaves in this country. And I remember when I was in, I think it was probably in high school, and I learned that the Jews were emancipated. It like made no sense to me. I don't understand it. I mean, I go to a suburban shul. I go to Friday night services. We're making Shabbos. There's the Hanukkah. What are you talking about? It suggested that we Jews, before we were emancipated, were slaves. We know we were slaves in Egypt, but were we slaves like in Europe before emancipation? The answer is we weren't necessarily slaves, but we didn't necessarily have rights. Now, it's hard even to conceive of that. We don't really think about that now. But you have to imagine yourself living in a world where there are people that are invisible to people who have rights. I think that's probably the closest thing. Because, by the way, it wasn't always the case that Jews lived in ghettos. Jews sometimes lived in towns with non-Jewish people all around them. They weren't necessarily segregated, but they were not free in that profound way that we understand ourselves to be free. Okay? So emancipation, by the way, was championed by what great French national leader?
Napoleon.
And Napoleon did an amazing thing for Judaism, which you might think is a positive thing, and you might think is a negative thing. He freed the Jews on condition. What was the condition that Napoleon imposed on the Jews? Do you know what? Do you know how would you describe it? Yes?
That they had to be French first and Jews second.
Yes. Not even a little bit stronger. I think the expression, and I'll translate it from French because I don't know French, is to the Jews, everything, to the Jewish people, nothing. In other words, as individuals in France, they were eligible for citizenship. But the notion was that their loyalty had to be exclusively to France, and their loyalty to their Jewishness had to be secondary. And you see that, I'll tell you, I remember the first time I learned about that too, which is pretty incredible. And you see, and I don't know about you, but I really empathize with the Jewish notables who had to answer Napoleon's questions. Can you imagine that? Napoleon, he calls together these Jewish notables and he says, I've got some questions to you. Do Jews consider Frenchmen to be their brothers? It's a very tough question, you know. Are Jews permitted to marry people who are not Jewish? You can imagine the anxiety of answering these questions, that if you answer it the wrong way, he goes ahead and says, well, these people cannot be made free. We're just going to have to keep them as, you know, sub-citizens. And if you want, you can read in the supplementary readings the answers that the Jewish notables gave. What did they have to give up? They had to give up the Judaism of belonging in order to become free. And once they did that, therefore, what kind of Judaism was central to their identity? It was the Judaism of becoming. Judaism became a religion for them. Previously, it was their national identity. So, what is the consequences of that? The consequences of that are that they understood their Judaism or their Jewishness in a much more narrow sense. They could go off and fight in the French army and feel virtuous about that, even if they were fighting Jews on the other side of the battlefield, as one of the answers to the questions points out. And the notion was they could dress like other Frenchmen, they could talk like other Frenchmen, and in fact, it had an impact on their own religiosity, because now that they were Frenchmen and women, rather than Jews, the noun describing them was Frenchmen. Jewish became an adjective. And so in order to be able to carry that off, Judaism itself had to change, and it became more modern. It became reformed. It was reformed so as to be more compatible with their new identity. Okay? Now, by the way, a lot of people, and by the way, after France's emancipation, and that took place after the Great Revolution, the French Revolution, you know, you can go watch Les Mis and you'll hear the music of the French Revolution. Other nations in Central Europe also emancipated their Jews. Now, many Jews were thrilled. Why would you be thrilled? Is it even a question? Is it a stupid question, right? I mean, why not be thrilled? What do you mean? I would rather have no rights? No, I'd rather have rights. I'd rather have the same rights as other French men and women. So many Jews were very happy to get the carrot, the stick being that they had to give up that sense of belonging to this thing called the Jewish people that kind of receded in their consciousness. they became Jewish Frenchmen, or Jewish Germans, or Jewish Austrians, or Jewish Belgians, do you see? As opposed to Jews who happen to live in Belgium, or Jews who happen to live here. Okay. Now, had this worked, we would not be in this class tonight. This class just wouldn't have worked, because if you think about it, the idea and the ideal is fantastic. It's fantastic. Think about it. To treat Jews like everybody else is fantastic. Why didn't it work? Well, I'm sorry?
So
that's a very interesting. It's a very interesting question, because what do you credit with the failure of the emancipation in Europe? One answer is Jews didn't assimilate enough. You could say, you know what? They still stood out. They still were different. That's one answer. What's another answer?
Lingering anti-Semitism.
Lingering anti-Semitism
would not allow those who wanted to be fully integrated to be fully accepted.
Yeah, so you know, it depends on where you stand, how you answer this question. I think the answer given by Max Nordau is really worth just taking a quick look at. And so if you have the packet, the Max Nordau is on page, Max Nordau's selection is on page 11. I'm sorry, a pen? Do you want one of these pens or one of these pens? Since I'm put these out, I'll give you those. Okay. Okay, does everybody have page 11 open to them?
Mm-hmm.
So, Max Nordau, who, by the way, was a very gifted orator, and he spoke at the First Zionist Congress in 1897. And he said, you know, if you want to paint a picture of the Jews, take a look at the first line of the second paragraph. This picture can, on the whole, be painted only in one color. Well, you know where he's going with this, right? It's not a very pretty color, right? The state of the Jews. Everywhere where the Jews have settled in comparatively large numbers among the nations, Jewish misery prevails. It's not the ordinary misery which is probably the unalterable fate of mankind. It is a peculiar misery which the Jews do not suffer as human beings, but as Jews, and from which they would be free were they not Jews. The Western Jew has bread, but man does not live on bread alone. Now, what does he mean, the Western Jew has bread? With emancipation came increasing economic security. You know, Herzl's parents were able to move from Budapest to Vienna once it became legal for Jews to live in Vienna. And they were fairly wealthy. They were bourgeois. They had money. But man does not live on bread alone. In the way he means it, you jump down about three lines. Jump down six lines, let's say, to get to the magnanimous laws. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
The magnanimous laws magnanimously lay down the theory of equality of rights. Right? That's what all of these European countries have given rights to their Jews. This is such an amazing paragraph from here on. I think this is incredible. Listen to what he says. But governments and society exercise the practice of equality of rights in a manner which renders it the same mockery as did the appointment of Sancho Panza to the splendid position of viceroy of the island of Barataria. He's talking about Sancho Panza, who's the assistant of Don Quixote. Okay? Listen to what comes next. The Jew says naively, I am a human being, and I regard nothing human as alien. But the answer he meets is, softly, your rights as a man must be enjoyed cautiously. You lack the right notion of honor, feeling for duty, morality, patriotism, idealism. You must therefore hold aloof from all vocations which take possession of these qualifications as conditions. In other words, what he's claiming, and he makes it very, very clear in the next section, is that even though rights were granted to the Jews, it didn't spring out of a true affection for Jews as human beings. It didn't spring from an understanding within the society that the Jews were in fact, deserving of these rights. It just came almost as a logical consequence from the fact that that everybody was a human being, so therefore they had to be given their rights. But anti-Semitism reflected the fact that it wasn't really authentic within the people. And so he claims, and others have claimed this as well, that anti-Semitism didn't disappear. And if you I spoke about this on the second day of Rosh Hashanah. You couldn't have a person more suited for assimilation than Theodor Herzl. I mean, he was really ready. He felt himself to be a Jew. He couldn't speak Hebrew. He didn't know Hebrew. He knew nothing about Judaism. He had a Christmas tree in his house. I mean, this is a Jew neither of belonging nor, frankly, of becoming. What turned him into a Zionist? It was when he recognized that anti-Semitism was here to stay. And so he suddenly, and it was really a dramatic shift for him, I reread a biography of Herzl, and it's just so chilling, you know, that he was covering the trial of Dreyfus, Alfred Dreyfus, in France, and he's watching the mob say, you know, the Jew killed the traitor Jew, you know, and seeing him identified as a Jew, you know, why not just as a French officer? What's that all about? And so Theodor Herzl said, you know, this project of the emancipation, which has gotten rid of Judaism of belonging, guess what? It's a failure. What do we need to do? We need, once again, to belong. Not to France and Germany and the United States and all these other countries. We have to belong to one another, and we have to restore what we once had. And so it's interesting that if you look at the declaration that was made at the First Zionist Congress. Yes, it's on page 3. You look at the bottom of page 3 on our packets. Everybody see that?
Mm-hmm.
This is what came out of the First Zionist Congress in August of 1897. The aim of Zionism is what? To create for the Jewish people. Not for Jews, not for individual Jews and their brothers and their mothers, but for the Jewish people. He's using the term the Jewish people. Don't take it for granted. There were others who claimed, no, it's the aim to create for the Jewish people a publicly and legally assured home in Palestine. Okay? And this becomes confirmed and endorsed and embraced by England in the promulgation of the Balfour Declaration in 1917. So it took from 1897 to 1917, 20 years, for that shift to be made. And with that shift, what we see is one particular type of Zionism gain in power and stature, because it is identifying a problem, anti-Semitism. It is identifying a solution, a home for the Jewish people in Palestine, and it's getting support for that effort. Were there other kinds of Zionisms? Yes. Were all Jews Zionists? No. So I don't want you to think that this Zionist, political Zionist response was universal. It was not. And one major Zionist response, which was not political, was the response of a man who called himself Ahad Ha'am. Ahad Ha'am is a man who's... it's nice to use the pen when you can. Ahad Ha'am was the pen name of a man by the name of Asher Ginsberg. He chose the name Ahad Ha'am. Does anybody know what Ahad Ha'am means? One of the people. By the way, you don't ever call him Mr. Ha'am. Or, you know, I was talking to Ahad the other day. No. it's a, you don't split it in two, right? Achad Ha'am. Achad Ha'am was, like most of the Zionists, okay, born and raised in a thoroughly traditional home. He knew how to daven. He knew how to keep, the Orthodox lifestyle. But he, like most of them, rejected that. He believed strongly in Jewish belonging, but to him, a political approach was not the right approach to take. And in fact, it could be disastrous. Now, we have a selection from Achad Ha'am, and I want you to take a look at that quickly. That is on page... I beg your pardon?
13.
Thank you. Page 13. You know, as I like to say whenever I teach Zionism, it's good to know who those streets were named after. And of course, in every major city in Israel, you have an Achad Ha'am street, okay? Just like you have a Herzl Boulevard. Now, which is the wider, grander, more prominent street? It's always Herzl Boulevard. Okay, Achad Ha'am is usually a small street in one of the residential neighborhoods. You've got to give him credit for something, but his Zionism was not political Zionism. He was an antagonist of Herzl. Look what he says. He says here, look in the middle paragraph. Judaism is in a quandary. It can no longer tolerate the galut form which it had to take on. Galut is exile. It's the word we use for the Judaism of the exile. Okay, next sentence. So it seeks to return to its historic center, where it will be able to live a life developing in a natural way, to bring its powers into play in every department of human culture, to broaden and perfect those national possessions, which it has acquired up to now, and thus to contribute to the common stock of humanity. In other words, he's talking about culture. Jump down about three lines to the right side. It does, do you see that? It does. It does not need an independent state, but only the creation in its native land of conditions favorable to its development. A good-sized settlement of Jews working without hindrance, the Jewish settlement will become, in course of time, the center of the nation. Then, from this center, the spirit of Judaism will radiate to the great circumference, to inspire them with new life, to preserve the overall unity of our people. When our national culture has attained this level, we may be confident that it will produce men, I apologize for the sexism there, in the land of Israel itself who will be able to establish a state there. One which will be not merely a state of Jews, last sentence and last line of the paragraph, but really, or a really Jewish state. What's the difference between a Jewish state and a Jewish state? What's the difference between a state of the Jews and a Jewish state? What do you think? Oh, well, you could... that's interesting. Which one do you say would you own?
It's owned by... like, before it was owned by the British, but because I became Jewish, now it was...
So which one is the one in which you say you own it?
The one in which we...
Who's we?
The Jewish people.
Okay. So you could say that the state of the Jews is one in which the Jews own it. And a Jewish state might be different from that. It might be... not one in which the Jews are running the show. Not in which Jews have sovereignty. You see, it was a very, if you think about it, looking back, this seems to be asking for a lot less than a Jewish state. And the fact is, he was asking for a lot less than a Jewish state. He just wanted Jews to be able to live free. Yes?
It also seems like he thinks one might negate the other one, like diminish the other thing.
Yes, he goes into that in the next page. He is extremely blunt about the dangers of politics, even the politics of national liberation. Now, I think, how many people have, yes?
Well, I was going to say, there's a difference, it seems, between Herzl was create the state and sort of what he wanted would follow.
Yes.
And Ahab.
Yes. Ahab
was really saying,
yes,
we want to create an environment, and that somehow, which I'm not sure I buy, but well, somehow a state, capital S, would follow just naturally.
Yeah, but it's more than that. It's all, I agree, but it's also, think about it, he alludes at the bottom of that page to a very interesting story in the Talmud, which you may be familiar with. The city of Jerusalem is under siege back in the days of the Second Temple. And the Romans are about to conquer Jerusalem. And what happens? Yochanan ben Zakkai, a great Jewish rabbi, gets himself smuggled out of the city of Jerusalem in a coffin. Ever hear the story? He comes out of the coffin, of course, because he's not really dead. He pops out of the coffin and he goes before he goes before the general who is commanding the forces that are about to conquer Jerusalem. And he says to the general, okay, "Hail Caesar!" Of course, the general says, "I'm not Caesar, I'm just a general." And then a messenger comes up and says, "Hail Caesar! Caesar is dead! Long live Caesar!" So, of course, as the story goes, he realizes that Yochanan ben Zakkai is not only a rabbi, but he's a seer. He's someone who can predict the truth, even when, or as a prophet, whatever. So he says to Yochanan ben Zakkai, "Why are you here for me?" And he says, "Don't ask me." He says, "Don't ask to spare the city of Jerusalem. I will not spare the city of Jerusalem. I will destroy the city of Jerusalem. But what would you like me to do?" And he said, "No problem, Yochanan ben Zakkai." In this legend, he says, "Let me take out of the city scholars, teachers of Torah, and let us establish a school in the city of Yavne, a small community outside of what will later be Tel Aviv, many, many years later. And let me teach Torah there." And so, of course, the general says, "Well, by all means, this is nothing to me. Take your Torah scholars out and establish your little community." And he does. And, of course, the city is then destroyed. Now, do you consider Yochanan ben Zakkai a traitor for bargaining for the scholars and allowing Jerusalem to be destroyed without a fight? Or do you consider him a hero looking back from 2,000 years of Jewish history? What Achat Ha'am is saying by quoting or referring to that story is that for the rabbinic project, Yochanan ben Zakkai is a hero because he was able to save Judaism. What kind of Judaism? Actually, both the Judaism of belonging and the Judaism of becoming, until such time as it could once again find rest and peace. And you get from this a perspective in traditional Judaism of not wanting to take up arms, not wanting to engage in what might be end up be suicidal or futile struggles against autocratic leaders, but instead to try to find a workable, peaceful solution. Do you see what I'm saying? And so he says on the next page, and this is really pretty interesting. Yes?
Is he really arguing that it was better to save the religion than to save the physical property?
Yes, absolutely. But yes.
And therefore, I don't care about the physical property. I don't care about us owning, quote unquote, a state.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's
right. I care about us owning our religion and our way of life. And
yes.
That's more important.
Yes. I would agree with you. Look what he says on the next page. The secret of our people's persistence. Okay? It's the third line at the top. As I've tried to show elsewhere, is that at a very early period, the prophets taught it to respect only the power of the spirit and not to worship material power. Don't try to learn how to take up arms and defeat the Turks or take up arms and defeat the British. This is not what we are about. Therefore, unlike the other nations of antiquity, the Jewish people never reached the point of losing its self-respect in the face of more powerful enemies. That is a powerful statement. That's saying that you can have self-respect even if you are powerless. Okay? Jump down about three lines. A political ideal which is not grounded in our national culture. Well, actually, let me read that line that I skipped. As long as we remain faithful to this principle, our existence has a secure basis and we shall not lose our self-respect, for we are not spiritually inferior to any nation. But a political ideal which is not grounded in our national culture is apt to seduce us from loyalty to our own inner spirit and to beget in us a tendency to find the path of glory in the attainment of material power and political dominion. thus breaking the thread that unites us with the past and undermining our historical foundation. So he makes the point, I think, that political Zionism is not where it's at. We need a renewal of our spirit. That's most important. Now, Bruce might be right that, in essence, perhaps he too would have agreed that eventually we need a state in order to address the challenges of anti-Semitism. But that wasn't his primary motivation. His primary motivation was to find what's called a spiritual center. And absolutely. And the reason I wanted you to read it, or I wanted you to hear it, is that you should realize, and this is one of the very great values of this course material, that what we might think of as the controversies of today have been with us for many, many years. And that is extremely important to remember, and therefore to acknowledge that some of the great, some people who are saying what people might say today are traitorous or disloyal or dangerous or contrary to the interests of the Jewish people were stated by some of the great heroes of the Jewish people only 100 years ago. And we shouldn't forget that. Now, I want to move just a little bit more, and then I have some questions for you. So the Balfour Declaration in 1917 privileges what kind of Judaism? Again? This is like one of these, really easy multiple choice questions, except since the words both begin with B, it's very easy to get confused. Belonging. The idea of Judaism of belonging. And as Daniel Hartman said in his lecture, Balfour isn't just the first step in international recognition of Israel. It redefines Jewishness through the lens of Zionism rather than through the lens of emancipation and the Enlightenment. You see, in other words, the Enlightenment and the emancipation suggested that Jews could be free individuals throughout Europe. Basically, Balfour is coming and rejecting that. Now, as a result, it was not universally popular among Jews, because the Jews who felt themselves the beneficiaries of the Enlightenment and the emancipation were not about to buy into this. And the best example of that is, of course, Montague. And I really encourage you to read that longer essay from which the excerpt for Montague is taken. Montague was a British Jew, or you could say, in his words, a Jewish Brit, who had made it. He was the third Jewish cabinet member in history. And for him, it was tremendously threatening to be told that the British were creating a home for who? The Jewish people, or a Jewish national home in Palestine. Why was that threatening to him? Because, he said, if that's my national home, I'm being told I don't belong here. And I might, in fact, be having to lose these rights that I have acquired. So it was a very, very troubling time for Jews. So,
for some, Rabbi, that his Enlightenment may be in danger.
I don't think.
Well, not his personal.
He wasn't arguing. I think he was arguing that his status was being endangered by Zionism.
Did he think that?
And I think he's right. I think he's absolutely right. Zionism did challenge his status, and we all know it today. Because as much as Israel, and I'm jumping like 50 years ahead, but you'll forgive me, as much as Zionism and the creation of the State of Israel was designed to solve the problem of anti-Semitism, has it solved the problem of anti-Semitism? Simple, multiple choice question here, right? No, no, or no. No, it has not solved the problem of anti-Semitism. You could argue, okay? I'm sorry?
In some aspects, it's made it worse.
Well, I'm not, anybody can say anything they want. I'm not sure I agree, but the fact of the matter is that there is still a virulent and unfounded hatred of Jews all over the world. I mean, just I don't know if you know this, but just the other day in Poland, for example, mm-hmm. there was a rally at which people were talking about, you know, getting rid of the Jews of Poland. Someone should tell them that actually they tried this a number of years ago, and actually, anyway. So anti-Semitism has remained, you know, and yet by defining, you know, this notion of a Jewish national home, it suggests that really maybe even the Jews agree with the anti-Semites that Jews don't belong anywhere else. So it's a very threatening picture. I remember I have grandparents who came from Germany, step-grandparents who came from Germany, and my grandmother's brother had gone to what was then Palestine in the 1930s when she came to America. And one of the reasons I think that they didn't talk too much with each other is that she was not particularly a Zionist, and he was. And he saw himself as rejecting the assimilationist effort, and she saw herself as benefiting from it and saw what he was doing as threatening to her. So on a personal level and a familial level, but also I think on a national level, we had this challenge of different approaches and, you know, and the bitterness that comes from this. Okay. I'd like to start now with a couple of questions. Okay? So let's talk a little bit about the Judaism of belonging and the Judaism of becoming. Or you could think of it as Jewishness versus Judaism. Do you sometimes think of yourself as a Jew in the world? Whatever you do and whatever you don't do, you're still a Jew? In other words, is Jewishness or is your identity as a Jew something unalterable, no matter what you do or don't do? And for that matter, so in other words, do you have a solid sense of yourself being a Jew of belonging? And do you think that's how the members of your family feel? So that's my first question. What do you say? You know, for example, you know, and just to distinguish it from the Judaism of becoming, you know, are you a person who's eating a ham sandwich or are you a Jew who's eating a ham sandwich? I mean, that kind of makes it sort of reinforces it, right? It's the idea that it's not about, you're still a Jew, right? It's like the Talmud says, you know, a Jew who sins is still a Jew. That's an inalterable. So does that describe who we are? Does that how you feel about who you are? Are you a Jew? Do you wake up in the morning? I'm a Jew. Do you go to sleep? I'm a Jew. That's who I am. That, in other words, even though I might not present myself that way, that's who I really am. Or is your notion, and this not either or, is your notion that you are a Jew of becoming? That Judaism, it actually binds you to behave in certain ways, and that you're duty bound to do these things to be worthy of that title, Jew. And do you think that's how members of your family feel? Well, what do you say? This is an inductive way of moving the discussion along. What do you say? Yes, it's also known as pulling teeth. But yes, yes, Carol.
I noticed my feeling of Judaism of belonging most strongly when I'm traveling to very different cultures abroad. When I was in China, when I was in Peru, because my sister-in-law is a Jew from Peru, you feel more part of the people, and no one is asking what you're practicing, and you really feel that.
Okay.
If for some reason you're presenting yourself, my brother traveled on business to Peru often, so he introduced himself to the conservative rabbi and said, you know, I'll be here often, I don't speak English, I don't know anybody except my business acquaintances. Immediately, the whole community embraced it. That's how he happened to meet his wife, but that's another story.
Okay.
But that's the Judaism of belonging, and nobody asked him how religious he was.
Okay. So just to sum it up, as I see it through a certain lens, Carol is saying, you know, she feels a sense of being a Jew of belonging when she's someplace else. When there's something that goes on in the head that you realize, wait a second, I must be a part of this people because I can connect with the Jew in China or with the Jew in Peru. It's not that you're connecting with the Peruvian natives. You're connecting with the Jew in Peru.
More so. Or okay. I'm more welcome.
Right. Okay. Anybody else have a feeling of being a Jew of belonging, per se? Yeah?
Well, I just think, I mean, you made a comment a second ago about how when she goes to, is it Peru?
Peru or to
that
China?
You know, that you feel, to me, like, no matter where I am, I'm a Jew. No matter where I wake up, whatever I do, wherever I go, I'm a Jew. Like, okay. It's just...
That's, and you feel that way?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, that's...
That's who you are, and that's how you feel. That's how you feel.
Yeah, I don't... It's
okay.
Just,
maybe I should have said... Other people relate to me that way if they're a Jew. Whereas here, it doesn't matter.
Okay. Well, Marla.
I feel the same way as Candace, but I also thought it was interesting. Whenever I'm somewhere else where you don't feel there's a lot of Jews, I see them as, there's a Jew here.
It's a connection.
Anywhere.
Yeah. Okay, so it's both. So in a way, okay, so then it's sort of like a both, not just either or, but both. Okay? Anybody else? Yeah.
So I look at it more as a lifetime step.
Yeah.
So when you're born, you belong. You are. But then as you're older, I think there's more of a becoming. So it's kind of like when you're born, you're kind of far to the left, belonging. And then as you're older as an adult, you're far to the right, becoming. And I think you're moving to the center from those two edges.
Okay.
So then balancing.
Okay. Here's my question. That's what Don is saying, that as you learn about Judaism, for example, presumably.
In my case.
In your case, you're feeling this literal sense of Jew of becoming. Because
The belonging is going this way, the becoming is coming this way, and they're meeting in the middle.
I'm sorry, I drew it the wrong way in the middle.
No, you...
Okay, I'm looking at your life journey as moving
yes, yeah,
in
I'm
this
not,
way.
I'm not looking at it that way.
Okay.
Yes, I had the becoming here, the belonging here, the becoming
so
here.
So they're converging.
They're converging.
Oh, so that's very interesting. So that's interesting, because that therefore they both continue on. They both continue on.
Yes.
Okay, so I apologize for that way of describing it. Maybe I should do it like this. You know, this is becoming, and this is belonging, and they both kind of, you know, they sort of both merge, comes into your life. Yeah, Bruce?
I sort of have the image of almost competing. There's a little bit of a competing process and maybe it depends on the time in your life that we sometimes are belonging more than we're becoming, and other times we're becoming more than we're belonging. I think it's, as I understand it at least, it's easier to belong because you are.
Right.
Whereas becoming requires some effort.
Okay.
And I think that either throughout our lives that changes our willingness or ability to make that effort. And then some people simply don't get past, I think, the belonging.
So let me ask you a question. If it's so easy to belong, are there, like Carol talked about moments when she really felt that because she had one of these encounters, and you've shared that too. But, you know, you encounter, oh, there's a Muslim, I got something in common with these. Are there moments when the Judaism of belonging is weakened within us, or when we feel that being challenged within us? When we don't, we not only feel not so necessarily belonging, but we feel an absence of that. Almost the opposite of that. Ken?
No,
oh, okay.
That hasn't happened for me. I was going to say that there are times the belonging for me feels much more like a part of my identity.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel like something I have to do.
Okay.
It doesn't feel like it's so related to practice or becoming, but it feels like it's just a part of who I am. There are times when the external world makes that harder. To belong, harder to sort of be out there belonging. But I had a time period where I was very much exposed to a lot of anti-Semitism.
Sure.
At that time, the belonging felt very strong. Sort of being out there about it was a little dangerous.
Okay, so in other words, paradoxically, you can both feel that increase in a sense of belonging when you are in some strange place and you find that there are Jews there, You can also feel that paradoxical sense of belonging when you're among anti-Semites. Yes?
So I think it also may be possible to look at it from the other way, which is that the increase in becoming also amplifies your sense of belonging.
Oh, but that, here's my question. I actually think that's a very interesting statement in the abstract, and we're going to see the possibility that that's actually true in some specific cases. But do you feel that for yourself? You're saying that's... Okay. Very interesting. Does everybody understand what Jessica means by that? No, you had your hand up. I'm sorry, Merle. Earlier when we were talking...
It was covered. I was just going to point out that I don't always agree that it's easy, that the belonging part is the easy part.
Well, it's certainly not easy when you're running into anti-Semites, right? Or even...
More than that. It's,
okay.
I mean,
well, then tell me why.
There are times when... And I grew up on Long Island, right? Very easy.
I've heard of Long Island, yes.
Very easy place to feel like you belong, even compared to here, which we're still in a pretty, good place for that. But there were times when I wouldn't want to tell someone I was Jewish.
Right. Right. So when you're in...
Not because I was afraid. I'm not saying because I was afraid, but because I was embarrassed or because I didn't want to be different.
Okay, so but there can be the embarrassment factor, by the way, is a key element in the evolution of Judaism in the Enlightenment. Arnold Eisen, who's the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary, wrote a book about modernity, which talked about how one of the reasons that Jews changed the way in which we worshipped once we were emancipated is that we became a little bit embarrassed by how non-Jews would think about us when they saw how we worshipped. So, for example, it used to be that Jewish worship was a lot more informal and less decorous. And when they saw how Protestant churches looked, they tried to imitate them so that they would look as proper. You see what I mean? So issues of how we feel vis-a-vis other people is a very important piece of this whole puzzle. Even when you're not necessarily being exposed to anti-Semitism. I mean, this is very interesting. Yes?
I don't think anything made Jews feel more a sense of belonging than anti-Semitism.
Say that again?
I don't think anything ever made Jewish people feel more a sense of belonging than anti-Semitism.
Okay.
Because
I'm sorry, what did I say? That
you said it's difficult because of anti-Semitism to have a feeling of belonging, and I'm saying it's the opposite. I mean, to me, anti-Semitism created a sense of belonging.
Well, I would say...
And maybe that's one of the things in America today is very much easier...
I think that there are two, maybe there are different, it's funny. Maimonides talks about loving God out of fear and loving God out of love. Or you might say loving God or fearing God. I feel the same way about Jewish belonging. I don't think that fear is an effective producer of devoted Jewish connection. I do feel that you're absolutely right. In a practical sense, anti-Semitism, reminds you, look, you got to stick with who, Right, exactly. I would agree with that. Jane?
I'm
sorry.
The difference between belonging and
I'm sorry.
Becoming. Very I understand. We've talked about it.
No. I'll just bring it out again because it's complicated. The language is a little bit confusing.
I was going to say, but for myself, by the decision, I think, within Judaism to keep kashrut.
Yes.
Makes it both. It makes it an everyday happening.
Yes. Well, so I think you're pointing out something very important, which is that many Jewish practices, in fact, have an element of belongingness, of reinforcing group identity, as well as of religiosity.
So I'd ask, what question would be like, how many of us, when we travel, say that we keep kosher or say that we're vegetarians?
Yeah.
And I know for myself, I was blessed with the name Jane Brown, so I travel in a Christian world, in a Muslim world. I can travel anywhere, and I travel places where I can't be a Jew, and yet I'm keeping kosher.
Yeah.
So I've got the Judaism is there no matter what I do.
So in a way, it's a little bit like you adopt as a practice what J.D. Gordon talked about, which is be a Jew at home and a man in the street, or a person in the street.
But I'm actually a Jew, because a lot of people keep kosher in their home and I help, but
yes.
I maintain
but
it
you're,
wherever.
Yes, absolutely.
And so it's with me everywhere I go.
Okay.
In a very subtle way. It has nothing to do with belief system for me.
Okay. That's another point that's very, very interesting, which is, what do we mean by this Judaism of belonging, of Jewish practice? Nobody can tell you why this particular person is observing this particular Jewish practice. It could be for this reason, that reason, or the other reason. And it could have a lot to do with belongingness.
I was just going to add to your question, mm-hmm. which was, what about our family members and what about particularly our children?
Yes.
So in my case, I have children that have made various decisions in terms of their belief system, in terms of their actions.
Yes.
But they all know what they're eating and when they're eating and why they ate it. So if they're eating a cheeseburger, they think about it's not what mom served me. And they've all chosen different acts. And so some keep kosher in our way.
They are Jews who choose to chew by choice.
But they're chew by choice, but they're thinking about their... So as much as they might deny that they're not belonging or becoming...
Yes. Very good. Okay,
so
I think what's interesting about Jane's comment is that it reinforces this statement that Daniel Hartman made, which is that, you know, we have to have these in balance to be in a healthy Jewish environment, whether here or in Israel. We need to have them in balance. And it's when they go out of balance that we run into problems. So speaking of which, let me ask you a question about Israel. Lamalo. I mean, this is a class in which we're studying about Zionism and about Israel, and Israel exists. How many of us have been to Israel? Okay, most of us have been to Israel, like 100% or almost. Okay, almost. One day, as they say. The great modern Jewish theologian, Franz Rosenzweig, who was born and raised in a secular Jewish home and then gradually adopted this and that religious practice, until, sadly, he became very, very ill and died at a very young age. But at one point, one of his interlocutors, I have this vague recollection that it might have been Martin Buber, but I could be wrong, said to him, he was trying to ascertain that he was somebody he could trust to really give him an honest answer about Judaism. He says, do you put on tefillin? And his famous answer was, not yet. That was his answer, not yet. Which I think is a very Jewish answer. Very Jewish answer. So the Balfour Declaration, to go back to Balfour, was an effort to secure a place where Jews could belong. But what about becoming? What do you think should be the obligation of the Jewish homeland vis-a-vis Jewish identity or Jewish practice or Jewish belief? So this follows up from Jane's comment. Should, for example, the state be a place where A, B, C, which would you say? A, kosher food is served at the Knesset, the Jewish parliament. Kosher food is available at the Knesset. Or B, only kosher food is available at the Knesset. Okay? C, is it a state where kosher food is available on the Israel National Airline? Or perhaps D, only kosher food is available on the national airline. What do you think? What is the obligation? What is the responsibility of this state of the Jews to be also a Jewish state?
Available,
but not only available. Mm-hmm. Meaning it should be available because we are Jews, and do you want to spin it out?
Well, there are people who would prefer that, but then there are people who are Jewish who don't necessarily need that, and they may choose to have something else. So.
Okay. Anybody else?
Well, for ease, it should be only available.
So for ease, it's only available because someone might by mistake order the shrimp cocktail, thinking it was fake shrimp. And in fact, it is shrimp, right? Is that the idea?
Yes.
Okay. So out of a sense of concern for the Jews possibly eating the wrong food, no. Yes?
Do we also have to be the same for both?
No.
Somehow the Knesset and the airline feel to me like they shouldn't necessarily be marching by the same rules.
They do not have to. I'm asking the questions, but you can provide the answers. What do you say?
I mean, the airline, you know, anybody is flying on the airline. They're Jewish, they're not Jewish. They bought a ticket, there's no rules. The Knesset, to me, has more of a presumption of
what?
Being a standard bearer for some sort of a belief system.
Okay.
The airline, maybe not so much.
Okay. But the interesting thing about that, of course, is that Israel was founded by, for the most part, secular Jews, political Zionists, the kind who Ahad Ha'am, excoriated, who didn't keep kosher themselves. There are religious Zionists and there are secular Zionists. So calling them Zionists doesn't answer it. In other words, the fact is that the secular Zionists, for the most part, were the ones who created the institutions that, that ultimately resulted in the Jewish state. But let me ask about that. Have you ever heard Israel referred to as the Jewish state? What do you understand that to mean? What does that mean to you? What do you think, first of all, does it have meaning? And is it true? And if so, how? What does it mean to call Israel the Jewish state? You'll hear it on the news all the time. What does it mean?
I guess I would associate it with the law of return.
Okay. And the law of return says what? It says that any Jew anywhere in the world, and not just any Jew anywhere in the world, anyone anywhere in the world whom the Nazis would consider a Jew, can come and land at that airport in Tel Aviv and become an Israeli citizen. Okay, so that's what it means to be a Jewish state. To be, if you can spell it out a little bit more, what does that mean? What does it mean?
Well, I mean, so I view it as associated with belonging.
Okay, so that there's a...
It's not a religious necessary. It's
especially since, if you think about it, it's explicitly including people whose religious identity is not Jewish. That's what's so fascinating about the law of return. The law of return grants a right to non-Jewish people to become citizens in the Jewish state if their status would have condemned them to be deemed Jewish by this most non-Jewish authority, namely Adolf Hitler. So someone who's married to a Jew, or someone who in fact is not Jewish but has one Jewish grandparent, even if that person is not halachically Jewish. I don't know if any of you even knew that. Did you all know that before it was stated by Daniel Hartman in his lecture. That's pretty fascinating. But that doesn't extend, as he said, beyond the airport itself. Once you get past the airport, guess what? It's a little bit different because of coalition politics and for other reasons. And one of the things, and this was in the talk, and I want to highlight it here. One of the features of modern Israel that is in many ways not just disappointing to us as American Jews, who have a particular Jewish identity here and may find it challenging when we go to Israel. But Daniel Hartman points out it's really a failure of the Zionist mission to have created a state which in fact does not grant the full right of Jewish belonging to all of its Jewish citizens. Do you understand why I say that? Because the only denomination that is granted a certain kind of status in the law in Israel is Orthodoxy. And non-Orthodox Judaisms, non-Orthodox visions of Judaism are considered foreign. They're considered what's called in Hebrew avodah zarah, idolatry. They're considered not representative of the Jewish people. They're considered, in fact, by the florid language of some Israeli politicians, enemies of the Jewish people. And you'll hear this, by the way, in Israel a lot, that Reform Jewish leaders are enemies of the Jewish people. And we don't usually merit such a great, such beautiful language, because we're often thought of as just an extension of the Reform movement. Otherwise, they'd say, V'chomim v'katzovativim, are ofdei avodah zarah. They're just idolaters. Now, I say this because it's actually an important feature of modern Israel for all of us to get into our skulls, that even though it was established in furtherance of the Balfourism of the Judaism of belonging, and even though it was established by Jews who didn't care too much about the Judaism of becoming, and for them, Don, the arrow doesn't get too close. I mean, you know, they... You know these famous stories about you know, how, you know, why the this particular government or that particular government fell because the prime minister arrived back home in Israel after Shabbat had begun, so therefore the religious parties stepped out of the coalition and brought down the government. Notwithstanding that, because of the way coalition politics played out, you have a privileging of Orthodox Judaism in Israel that is in many ways pushing many, many Jews in Israel to a Judaism of not becoming. A Judaism of belonging, yes, but a Judaism of not becoming. Yeah.
I felt the Judaism of not belonging in Israel.
Okay.
Like going.
I was going to ask you about that. Do we feel when we go to Israel that we belong? Now, do you feel a not belonging in Israel or not belonging within Judaism as a Jew? And is it the same?
I probably would say I feel belonging in Israel, but I don't feel belonging as a Jew.
In Israel.
Israel,
okay. Anybody else, by the way? I mean, if you can think back to that trip to Israel or those trips,
no,
yeah?
No, I had the same feeling, that we were second-class Jews, I guess I would put it that way. We really didn't come up to a standard that many people have, many Orthodox people have, because we didn't embrace everything that they did. So therefore, we didn't really count.
And yet, because I hear,
I felt a huge emotional connection to the country.
Yes.
When I was living in Israel, very strong sense of Jewish belonging, and the people who are feeling that they don't fall from this lacking a sense of Judaism as belonging is really lacking the sense of Judaism as becoming. Because that's what's missing there, and that's what's the different sliding scales. There's no question that when most of us get there, people say, I feel so at home here. I've never felt that way before. It's the absolute feeling of Judaism, of Jewishness as becoming, as the Zionist becoming state. When you try to measure Judaism as becoming, everything gets confused. I mean, it's hard work. You have to work at your identity. You have to always think about who you are, why you are. That some people feel is what's missing when they go to Israel. And I think it's you're confusing the two when you're feeling this. Lacking.
Let's draw a picture and just remind ourselves that there are two very different societies, Israel and the United States, for Jews. Okay? So if we put Israel over here, and we'll put the U.S. over here. So in Israel, what is the basis of one's Jewish identity in Israel? What is it that makes one conscious that one is a Jew? What is it that one sees as significant to one's Jewishness in Israel? Yeah, Ken?
The Hebrew
language, right? You don't have to go out the door. You just turn on the television, and you're speaking, and you're hearing Hebrew. What else? Yeah?
When you're walking through the streets on Shabbat, people say Shabbat Shalom.
So this is interesting. That's different from Hebrew language, but maybe it isn't. In other words, they may say Shabbat Shalom to you even if they're not religious, right? It's more of a national consciousness of the day. Yes, there was a hand over here. Okay. Yes, Candice?
Well, back when you're in Israel during the Shabbos, the elevators open at every floor.
So you've got automatic elevators.
You can't go straight to your floor. You got to go to each one.
You know, it reminds me of a joke, but we'll leave that aside. But yes, automatic elevators on Shabbat, which is another, you know, that's a little different from the idea of people saying Shabbat Shalom, because even people who might be willing to take an elevator would still say Shabbat Shalom to you. But we had a hand up.
Yeah, the entire calendar.
The entire calendar.
Yes.
Amazing. The entire calendar is really, and it reminds me, I'll never forget, I was in a doctor's office in Jerusalem, and I was waiting to see a doctor, and a woman came out of one of the doctor's offices and was calling to and was making the next appointment for herself or her husband, and she said, "Well, I'm free on the 17th of Cheshvan." And it was fascinating to me because without batting an eye, you know, the receptionist behind the desk said, "Well, you know, I think we need to see you on the 16th of Cheshvan." Now, I'll tell you got to be really quick at the draw, okay? So that's not not what we would expect. Yes.
Two things, sort of related to calendar. Being in Israel on Christmas or during the Christmas season is really unique, and then being in Israel when there's a war going on.
Okay, so this is interesting. We're talking about how the Christmas in Israel, and I don't know if I dare to show all of you the video of myself in Israel in front of the YMCA while the music is playing. The Muzak at the YMCA on Christmas Day is Mariah Carey singing "All I Want for Christmas Is You." I mean, you just have to see this. Christmas in Israel is, except in front of the YMCA in Jerusalem, really a very interesting experience. And then the other was war. Now, I mean, that is true. War is it clarifies the mind. You know, I mean, you know, I was in Israel once when your daughter was in a settlement in the north and bombs were flying, and next thing you know, she was sleeping on our couch.
And we arrived 2 days later.
Yeah, and all was well. And all was well. But, you know, there's like a different feeling in the air. Right. So the idea of war, is there a unifying theme here? It's very interesting. What kind of Judaism is reinforced here? What kind of Judaism is experienced here? Well, I would say, what would you say? I mean, I know this is a bit of an artificial distinction, this Judaism of belonging and Jews in becoming, but what do we see here? What kind of Judaism is this?
Belonging.
Why do you say belonging?
Well,
I mean, I think it's probably a smart answer, but I'm just trying to flesh it out. Bruce?
I mean, I see automatic elevators, and that strikes me as more becoming.
That's more becoming, the automatic elevators.
That's not necessarily your choice.
Well, no, say that again?
But it's based in the becoming.
It's based on an idea of an ideal that you don't use the elevators, right? Whereas saying Shabbat Shalom, you could be saying Shabbat Shalom when you're, you know, I'll never forget. I'll tell you another story, but that's all right. The bottom line is you don't have to be religious. You don't have to be observant. Shabbat Shalom becomes the national way of greeting people on Shabbat. Yes?
I was going to be cynical. I'd say most of these are just reactions to living in the society we live in America.
I'm confused. I'm sorry.
Because we're living in a Christian society, so except for saying Shabbat Shalom. So if I was to see a random person from our temple on Friday afternoon, I probably would not say Shabbat Shalom to them here.
But in Israel,
I would, of course. But in
We'll get to America in a minute.
But everything here is a reaction to living in a Christian world.
Oh, you're saying? I'm not sure. Are you saying it's a reaction? We experience that as a reaction of our living in a Christian world. I'm asking about Israelis too. Now, I would say, you know, and the reason it becomes parallels, you have to ask, when an Israeli comes to America, what does that feel like? Before we get to that, though, let's talk about Americans, okay? American Jews. I don't think I have enough room here. So let's just go here. Let's do it over here. We've got the U.S. Here we are. Where, when, how do we experience our Jewishness and our Judaism? Yeah.
Belonging to a synagogue is one of the first.
Okay. Belonging to a synagogue. Okay. It's so interesting. You could write belonging to a synagogue. You could also say going to a synagogue.
Yeah.
You know, or passing by a synagogue, right? What else? Yeah.
So I actually think for a lot of people it's bagels.
Bagels.
Don't forget the lox.
Yeah, bagels. Yeah. Yes.
Did school starting to give Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur off?
So holidays off.
Not the colleges and universities, though.
Okay, let's just leave that there for that. Holidays off. Some holidays on, some holidays off. Yeah?
Movies on Christmas Day and Chinese food.
On Christmas Day.
Or Mexico.
Okay. Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
Christmas makes me feel really joyous.
It's very interesting. Christmas, to some people, does make you feel that way. Anything else? What makes you feel Jewish? Think about it. You go through your week, and what is it that makes you feel, or that reinforces, or that generates that feeling of Jewishness? Yeah?
Lighting Shabbat candles and having Shabbat dinner.
Guilt.
Okay. Lighting Shabbat candles.
Guilt. Guilt for not lighting the Shabbat candles. And
oh, okay. Lighting guilt. Shabbat candles or guilt for not doing so.
Not making it to Shul. All the other guilt.
Okay. And Passover.
Kosher food. Okay. What else? Does the language in which we speak reinforce our Jewishness? Does the calendar that we, you know, go by reinforce our Jewishness? Okay. Does hearing about a war that we're involved in reinforce our Jewishness? Depends. Okay. One sec. Yeah, Lauren?
Life events.
Life cycle events, yeah.
Like weddings, funerals.
Okay.
Mitzvahs, bat mitzvahs.
Births. Weddings, funerals, bar mitzvahs.
Brises.
Okay, Bruce?
Anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
Actions.
Anti-Semitism. That seems to be, isn't it, almost like a common element both here and in the one in Israel. I agree. Here it's anti-Semitism, there it's a war. That certain, you know, conflict does have a way, threats have a way of exciting a certain, yes, Rose Jane?
Belonging to a Jewish community, but not talking about, like you said, in Jewish friends.
How about for a Jewish community?
Yeah.
And, yes, very interesting comment, Jewish friends. Okay. Yeah, Candace?
Well, I was going to build on that, that if I was raising teenage adult children in Israel, mm-hmm. I wouldn't have to worry that when they date, that most likely they'd be dating somebody who's Jewish or marrying, having relations with somebody who's Jewish. Where here in the United States, it's more of a concern that
so
date. I think it's easy. I think in Israel it would be easier for them to meet somebody who's Jewish and have that.
So, would you say that, again, continuing the U.S., again, thinking about the idea of when and how does this increase your sense of Jewishness? Is
because
it watching your kids date?
It's the concern, yeah.
It's the concern.
The concern that they...
Concern.
Even though I married out of the faith, but I kept my family Jewish and the Jew. The concern that they're not going to follow that tradition.
Concern, rate, continuity. Okay. Concern about continuity. Yeah. Ellen?
Sometimes just explaining to non-Jewish friends what particular holidays are about.
Yeah.
Being non-Jewish
being
friends.
Being the Jew explaining Judaism.
Yeah.
You know, I brought in my shirts to be cleaned. I guess it was this morning. And the man behind the counter said, and very politely and very reverentially, you know, when is the next Jewish holiday? You know, because I brought in all that. I mean, he's concerned, you know. Like, wants to make sure, you know, because he knew, like, there was these weeks when it was like, well, I can't see you after Wednesday. You know, it's Monday through Wednesday, that's it. Monday through Wednesday. So I said, well, not till Hanukkah. I said, okay. And then he said, and after that? So, I mean, there is that sense that we have, you know, that even if we don't wear a yarmulke, and even if we're not, like, professional Jews, there is this interface that we have. And that interface kind of, you know, heightens that sense of, oh, well, we are who we are. Anything else before I want to... Yes.
A continuation of that. My daughter has a necklace that says Rivka, even though she's not religious or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But she has been stopped so many times on a train or somewhere else. And they say, oh, you're Jewish. And, you know, it's like
yes.
an interesting...
So it's a sociological marker.
Right.
Having a mezuzah or having a necklace that says Rivka. Okay? So there are markers that we can wear that distinguish us. By the way... I'm not suggesting that everyone try this, but, you know, there are other sociological markers that we could be wearing. We could wear kippot, for example. What else could we do that would be sociological markers that would have the same impact? Cover our heads in different ways, right? So there are all sorts of things we could do. We could imagine ourselves wearing traditionalist Jewish garb, right? Now, it's interesting. You'll see a lot of people with traditional Jewish garb in Israel, too. They are non-Zionists, okay? They're not, their whole approach to Israel is very comparable to the approach they would have to any other nation state in the world.
Even if it's,
well, they okay. Now, let's try to sum this up, because time is zipping by. So we started by looking, and this is a key, this is kind of like the summation of the entire issue here. We looked at Israel, and we said there are a whole bunch of these things that sort of, you know, make living in the culture there naturally, willy-nilly, inevitably Jewish. Many of these are the Judaism of belonging. You know, you share the Hebrew language. You don't choose your mother tongue. You don't. And they're living in a Jewish country, so this is what it is. Okay? Shabbat Shalom. Again, not out of religiosity. There's no religious content. There's no explicitly doctrinal religious content to the expression Shabbat Shalom. Okay? I mean, presumably you could have a Jewish gangster say, Shabbat Shalom, give me your wallet. You know? I mean, conceivably. It's totally conceivable. Yeah?
There is some acknowledgement that it's Shabbat.
It is. Well, yes, yes, yes. No, you're absolutely right. But that's an acknowledgement of Shabbat as the national day of rest. In other words, it's Jewishness as a national identity, basically.
It's like somebody saying Merry Christmas to you, even though they're not, it might be.
The automatic elevators on Shabbat, you know, that is moreover of, you know, the Judaism of, you know, becoming. The calendars, we said. Christmas in Israel is kind of a funny example here, because it's sort of like, that's really, for us, when we're in Israel, at picking up on what Jane Brown had said, that we feel that when we go to Israel. I'm not so sure that an Israeli who doesn't experience Christmas here experiences Christmas in Israel any differently than, let's say, St. Sylvester's Eve, which is New Year's Eve. You know, it's, okay. And war, of course, is also a national challenge. Now, we saw in America, well, anti-Semitism, which is that common, you know, whenever that comes up, that is enough to make one feel like a Jew. But other elements here, for the most part, belonging to a synagogue or a Jewish community. Some people said bagels, although I'll never forget, I went to that bagel place in Chestnut Hill, and someone, you know, I asked what kind of bagels they had today. She said, well, the special today is, I don't know, like blueberry, honey, mustard, or some bizarre thing. And I said, that's not a bagel. And the woman looked at me and she said, and in her perfect Portuguese accent, she said, we sell a lot of these. And I'm sure they do. So, you know, and if you think about it for a moment, you know, the bagel unites us with some Russians that we didn't necessarily like very much and who didn't necessarily like us, but we associate that with a certain kind of Eastern European cuisine. Holidays off, yep. Movies and Chinese food on Christmas Day. Christmas itself, lighting Shabbat candles. Gilded not lighting Shabbat candles. Passover, kosher food. I think it's a bit of a mix. It's a bit of a mix. We sort of, you know, have a sense of being different from others. Some of us do. But we also tend to cultivate Jewishness in Jewish spaces. We tend to cultivate Jewishness in Jewish spaces. In a sense, it's the fulfillment of J.D. Gordon's comment. What did he say? Be a Jew at home and a person out in the street. And for the most part, that's what we do. Let's face it. And what that means, and I don't know if I've indicated it strongly enough, but in fact, okay, this is again, here there's the question about Jewish continuity and being a Jew. Okay. In the language of in the language, the dire language of Daniel Hartman, we in America see our Jewishness expressed most naturally as a Judaism of becoming. And in Israel, most naturally as a Judaism of belonging. Both of those are skewed. They're not balanced. And not only that, they're not balanced in different ways. So therefore, and he claims, and I think this is spot on, he says, this divide, and this will be a nice way to, for us to kind of like bring this to a close, this divide is threatening to grow even wider. For non-Orthodox Israelis, okay, for non-Orthodox Israelis, so picture them in your head, to be Jewish is very Balfourian, meaning it's to be part of the Jewish people whose homeland is Israel. Judaism, Jewishness, is principally a national identity. Okay? On the other hand, in North America, liberal Judaism is increasingly a Judaism of becoming. And he sees there a great challenge for all of us, Jews in Israel and Jews in America, to try to pursue a new balance. Let me close by just telling you something I observed this past weekend, which was really very fascinating and touching to me. I happened to be in the grand city of Brooklyn, New York, for Shabbat. I was officiating at a wedding in Brooklyn on Saturday night. And I was in a shul, and the synagogue had invited for their Friday night dinner a group of Shin Shinim. Do you know what the Shin Shinim is? The letter Shin. Okay, so a Shin Shin stands for Shin Shin. What does it stand for? Shnat Shirut in Israel, a year of service. These are Israeli 18-year-olds who are taking a year off after high school, before the army. And there are a whole bunch of things that Israeli kids do. This one thing is it's basically a kind of shlichut. It's a form of going to America, representing Israel, as part of a group from the Jewish agency. But they're particularly, the age is chosen because these are kids who are willing to take a year off. And their mission is to really talk about Israel and to share what they know about being an Israeli with Jewish American high school kids or kids at college who are just like their same age or 1 or 2 years above them. But in speaking to them, so they came, these Shin Shinim came, and there were some young people at the shul who were there, and they were having dinner together. And then we engaged in a general discussion, and they said, you know, I have to, like somebody said, why did you choose this? You could have done some other program in Israel, you could have gone some other place else. And they said, to a person, almost all of them were from essentially secular Jewish backgrounds. One of them was from a Sephardic religious family. And what did they say? One of them in particular said, you know, I came here to learn more about Judaism. I came here to learn more about Judaism, and I'm learning a tremendous amount about Judaism. And at the same time that I'm sharing what it's like to be a Jew in Israel, I'm learning about what it's like to be a Jew, period. And the rabbi who was there said that last year, the group of Shin Shinim, as they were about to leave, one of the young women came up to her and said, you know, before I leave, could I have an aliyah? Because she was going home, and she was not going to be having an aliyah at home. But she had observed this conservative synagogue and knew that women could have aliyot, and so she learned how to have an aliyah, and she agreed to have an aliyah. But it was a real... So the point I'm trying to make is I think what we've learned from our study of 1917, it's really not a study of 1917, it's a study of the themes that are brought out by 1917, is that finding a homeland or moving toward a homeland for the Jews creates some turmoil in the Jewish world, and in some ways we're still living with that turmoil today. Next week, we take a look at 1947 and what that symbolizes about the challenges of Zionism in the real world that we live. Because 1947... and in particular, the 29th of November in 1947. Kaf Tet B'November. I have friends who lived on Kaf Tet B'November Street in Jerusalem. The 29th of November Street. On that date, the United Nations affirmed the partition of the state, of the Palestine mandate into a Jewish state and an Arab state. And in accepting that mandate, in essence, the Zionist movement, which by now is a very mature post-World War II movement, was essentially affirming a certain perspective toward what was possible and what was ideal. In essence, it was all about compromise. So we're going to talk about that next time. If you would like, and I would urge you to, take a look at the texts that are at the beginning of the second unit in your booklets. Okay? Thank you very much. And again, any questions or comments, feel free to send me an email.